So guys, Roland here. I understand that souls incarnate on Earth to play myriad roles in what is referred to as a one-room school. And the question here is, what role do you think you're playing? And my guest and I are going to discuss some of this next.
Welcome to Conversations with Roland, where the goal of this show is to learn life secrets through diverse experiences. I am your host, Roland Achenjang.
Guys, welcome to another episode of Conversations with Roland. As always, I am super excited to record these conversations, and today is no different. Today, we will be talking about Houdini kids and blindfolded bodhisattvas, labels attached to multiple souls who incarnate on this planet and play different roles for us. And with me to talk about this is an amazing guest who is a regular in Conversations with Roland. She's an author, a speaker, a Reiki practitioner. She's appeared on myriad podcasts and radio shows promoting her book, Remember, Every Breath is Precious. Dying Taught Me How to Live. And I'm talking about none other than my very good friend, Leslie Joan Lupo. Leslie, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Great. Thank you for inviting me again.
It's my pleasure. I absolutely enjoy talking with you. I think you had a very fascinating and amazing experience. And with that, went through this life transformation that has left you filled with a ton of information that really would be a lot of benefit to all of us who get the chance to discuss with you or even listen to what you have to share. So,
great, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. So just a little recap. If anyone has listened to my show before, any of your conversations, they have a pretty good history of who Leslie Joan Lupo is, right? You had a near-death experience in March in the 80s, and you had an amazing time in what you call upstairs, which most people would attribute to as heaven. And today, I was hoping we would focus a little bit on something you remembered you did in, you know, previously before your current incarnation on Earth. And that was placing souls, right, in different parts of the world.
Yes.
And can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Well, I got caught in a stampede, you're right. In March of 1988, and I died in it. I watched the stampede occur with a great sense of serenity and love, and then suddenly Tucson just evaporated, and I was in what I at first called upstairs. I didn't know where I was, so I had a different label for it. The thing is, I was given a choice to come back to Earth. A lot of people who cross over to that level are told you have to return. And a few people don't have to. But with me, they said, you have to return or you can stay. You don't, it's your choice. And so me being me, I had to ask questions. And I asked, what do I do up here? And they said, my soul group was in charge of placing these elders down on Earth. And they explained to me what the bodhisattvas we were placing, because the bodhisattva is an enlightened being that decides to come back, different than the ascended masters that don't incarnate again. And they will come back to be teachers and to be guides. And what they showed me was all through the history of Homo sapiens, elders have been coming down, the families, the cultures protect them because they see that the child is gifted with a egoless spiritual connection to God, and they elevate the consciousness of the culture. Around the mid-1800s, another level of bodhisattva began to incarnate. And that was because global consciousness had evolved to the point where we were beginning to have an earthling vibe rather than all these little pockets of tribes that were at war with each other. And at that point, these blindfolded bodhisattvas were being incarnating. And that was my soul group's journey, is to place them. And the difference is a bodhisattva had the call within their heart to be of service to the divine. In whatever culture they were born in, they became part of the religious teachings. A blindfolded bodhisattva had that memory erased. That's why I called it blindfolded. And yet they were put into young souls, young families that had no recognition of the child's gifts because the child himself or herself didn't know. And they were not, it could be the culture, it could be the community, it could be within the family. There was a lot of turmoil and anger and fear. They had to look around and realize, I can't pick up these teachings. So the reason that the blindfolded bodhisattvas were coming down was because people, in my analogy for people, as you start in a baby play group, that's your first incarnation. By the time you get to be enlightened, you're a PhD. So all through that, you've got grade school, junior high school, college, you know, and then extended education, and you keep evolving. So these bodhisattvas were being born into families that were older souls themselves. And when they're in a church or a synagogue or a temple teaching, who's going there? Usually high school or junior high. So the others are not having any inclination for any type of spiritual teaching. I mean, heart-centered, egoless spiritual teachings. So the blindfolded bodhisattvas came down to, number one, break the generational prejudices. So they could be taught that you can't like them because of a rivalry, or they could be taught that you can't, you know, these people are no good or this country's no good. And their common sense and their love of humanity would say, that just doesn't make sense. And they would be the ones that would look around, feel like an outcast because they weren't resonating with these younger souls, and had to go within and find their own spiritual blueprint and find their connection to God or a spiritual path. So that would have been a struggle for them. And so a lot of what I read when I read the descriptions of empaths is very applicable to these blindfolded bodhisattvas, simply because what we did was we went into families and cultures and or communities or schools or whatever that were rigid and excluding others, or a lot of rage and a lot of fear. Then what would happen would be that we would elevate the consciousness, because the older souls are going to these spiritual centers, the younger souls are not, but we're breaking that chain by not mimicking and embodying what we were being taught. But what we did was we would almost like absorb all the negative energy in order to transmute it. And that was where the empaths get caught, is because we, like a vacuum cleaner, we take away all the negativity, but we ingest it. And so it's better to become like a leaf blower, which is why I became a Reiki master, so that we can learn to channel energy that's healing and put the light into someone that kind of blows off the negativity rather than suck it into ourselves. Because it's our nature in humans to give someone a hug, which means I'm taking your burden onto me and giving you the lightness that comes when you don't have a burden. Well, when I became a psychologist, we were trained, you can't do that. You've got to be objective. You have to not absorb their negativity, but be a light in the darkness. That was kind of what we were doing. The second thing they were doing is, because most Houdini kids have had some, a lot of shocks as a child, they're selfless to a fault. And if they're seeing selfish behavior, they're going to have a very strong awareness that this is not the way we're supposed to be doing it. So they had to learn to be selfless, but not selfless to a fault, by simply including themselves in their decisions. Is this in my highest good too? It's not ever going to be selfish, like that's me only. And this one is just include myself too. And then the third thing Houdini kids have to learn how to do is how to play and lighten up a bit, because when we see negativity, it's on our default program to just absorb it and transmute it. That gets very heavy.
Yeah. No, all valuable info, of course, as always. You're so like super knowledgeable about this, Leslie, which is really why I appreciate talking to you. Now, in listening, right, you do mention quite a few names. You talk about Houdini kids. You talk about empaths. You talk about blindfolded bodhisattvas, as well as bodhisattvas and ascended masters. Those were some names that I picked up.
Yes.
And if we can, before we continue, at least help create a framework so that we know which ones are at least in your mind referring to the exact same souls, and then which ones are different.
Good question. When I first had my near death and came back and was trying to figure out what was that, I would use the word blindfolded bodhisattva, which is quite a tongue twister. One day, a few years ago, maybe about 8 years ago, I'm watching a documentary on magicians, and here's Houdini. And the first thing they do is they put a blindfold on him. And I just went, oh, I'm supposed to be paying like a little tap on the head. Pay attention. So I'm watching it, and they tie him up in a chain. They put him in a bag. And they throw him, they're on a dock, they throw him in the water. He has to do this all by himself. He is bound and gagged, and it's like he has no, it's not like he's just put in a bag and thrown in. He's got these impediments. And that's what I realized was an analogy for the blindfolded bodhisattva, which is why I started calling them Houdini kids. Because like indigo kids, it's just like, it's actually a bridge between the bodhisattva and the indigo kids, which we can talk about later. But the empaths are people who I think many of them are these Houdini kids, but they don't know it. Because the blindfolded bodhisattva / Houdini kids are so egoless, they are people that have a very hard time saying, I'm a bodhisattva. And yet they know right from wrong. They never waver. They know when something's wrong, and they react to it. Now, going back to the definitions, the bodhisattva is someone that has moksha, that has enlightenment. But instead of going into heaven, into nirvana, they turn around and they come back down to help. An ascended master is someone who had moksha and went into nirvana so that they can be fueling the spiritual work down here.
But not necessarily for the ascended masters reincarnate as often as the bodhisattvas.
Yes. And the bodhisattva, the best one to talk about would be the Dalai Lama. Most of them, 99% of them, will never know who they are because they're egoless and they're quiet. But because of what happened in Tibet, we became very aware of this 14th Dalai Lama. We didn't know the 13th or the 12th, but when you read his story, they did an astrology chart on the death of the previous Dalai Lama, and they were told exactly where latitude and longitude and exactly the date. So they go to that village, when 5 or 6 years later, and here's a little boy playing in the yard, and he sees these monks walking, and his mother said he ran in the house to the altar, grabbed some beads, and said, "Bye, Mom," and runs out the door. Of course, she's running right after him. And he walked up and he bowed to the monks, and they realized with some questioning that this young man, this little child, was the Dalai Lama that we know right now. And Bodhisattva is self-aware. They're born into a family and a community that supports the spiritual teachings that Bodhisattva needs. So it could have been a young girl in the 1500s. She's born in Italy, and they put her in a nunnery because she wants to be a nun and just serve God. So depending on the culture, shamans, medicine people all have that. In the 1850s, that shifted. Now we have Bodhisattva still incarnating, and we also have these blindfolded ones, Houdini kids, being born to elevate a particular facet of human evolution, which is breaking the chains of prejudice.
Great. No, I love it. And just a side note, I haven't studied much about how the Dalai Lama gets picked, but I really appreciate that story. And the one aspect that I do remember about that process is that when the Dalai Lama reincarnates, he has to identify, or she, or the soul, the being has to identify a set of artifacts or trinkets that he left or she left in a previous lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I think that that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing. Especially since the child is usually between the age of 5 and 6. The other thing interesting is that on their deathbed is when the Dalai Lama decides if they're going to incarnate or not. They don't have to.
Ah, fascinating.
So when our Dalai Lama that we all know is on his deathbed, they will be asking, would you like to come back or not? If not, then they go in one direction for finding the next Dalai Lama. If he says yes, then they stay with that tradition.
Oh, I see. Interesting. So another thing you talked about was that these blindfolded bodhisattvas are coming in now to elevate a particular aspect of the current earth life experience, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask, which level of souls are the ones sort of expressing this level of earth life that the blindfolded bodhisattvas find purpose in coming to sort of change or transmute or elevate?
Interesting. That's to go back to regular bodhisattvas, because they are the ones that are the spiritual leaders in their culture. Again, without ego, they're working more one-on-one with people. The blindfolded bodhisattvas are not working with one-on-one. They are here to elevate consciousness. So it's like, you know, putting in 5G over 4G. It's just amping up the juice that's available for transmutation. But they're not the ones that are here on a specific, I'm drawn to being a Native American medicine woman and I walk my path and I'm working in this tribe, or I'm a priest in a Catholic church and I'm doing everything I can to elevate the town I'm in. The Houdini kids are solely here to break that chain, because if they're trying to teach me prejudice is taught. Nobody is born hating someone from a gender or a color skin or anything. Children play without any boundaries. They just run and jump and play. And so the Houdini kids are here to absorb this negativity around them and not pass it on. Did you know that when a woman is beat up by her husband, for example, about 65% of those girls, well, 100% of the girls that witness the mother being used as a punching bag, 65% of them will go and find an abusive relationship, because it's in their subliminal program that they can consciously be aware, but it's way too deep in the subliminal, and they are going to be gravitating. Now, when I was in college, it was almost 80%, and it's dropped down to like 62, 63%. So education is teaching us that women and children are not supposed to be punching bags for anybody. So from that perspective, what we're looking at is the elevation of the juice that has consciousness. The best way to do it is, let's say humanity is growing and we're under a tenth, and all of a sudden we've grown so much, our heads are getting close to the top of the tent. Houdini's kids come in and put up another pole that may give us 10 more feet. So we're like, and we're holding that space for growth by not going on and repeating what we were taught.
Okay.
So for people that were beaten as children, they're the ones that will go, that was horrible. And when they have children, they just decide to do it a different way. It's for those changes.
I see. So in your mind then, what are your thoughts about the enlightenment level of attainment that blindfolded bodhisattvas or Houdini kids have attained?
They're bodhisattvas. Just like the Dalai Lama, they are enlightened, but have chosen to come down in a blindfolded manner, where they have to do all the work within. And that's one of the biggest things that I've gotten feedback on from my book and lectures, is so many people who have had turbulent, difficult childhoods think that, oh my gosh, I must have been like Genghis Khan in a previous lifetime because I'm being so abused here. It's got nothing to do with that. I can't speak for younger souls who have to do that payback part of reincarnation, but the people that have the most sense of relief are the ones that had been taught the only reason someone punched you in the face and stole your purse was because you did that to someone else. And now it's like, no, the only reason you got punched in the face and your purse got stolen is because you generate a higher level of forgiveness. And you're not going into the, I'm going to shoot you now because you did this. You don't escalate negativity, you dissipate it.
Yeah. And I, speaking from my experience, especially growing up way back in Cameroon, West Africa, my neighbors who lived down the road from us, we lived a little bit on a hill, were always fighting each other. And that for me personally was really, 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 really tough to be a part of and be in that environment. I really disliked any sort of violence, eruption or emotional outbursts that would be, you know, labeled as negative. And it would make my heart race. And I would feel so uncomfortable around an environment like that. And I don't know why I took it personally. It was never directed at me. Right? It was always at each other, but just the energy around it was unbearable.
Well, you said a really good thing there when you said I took it personally. Children, up until the age, don't forget we have a child brain until our mid to late 20s. We don't get into young adult brain, developmental psychology says we don't get into young adult brain until our late 20s to mid 30s. So when you're in a child format, you absorb everything, and Houdini kids absorb everything because it's a default that we pull in all the negative energy like a vacuum cleaner to help the situation. Even though we don't feel it's our fault, we absorb it as if it is, as children, because that's a default. But there's so many studies where if a mother and a father are fighting about the checkbook in the kitchen, and the children are two rooms away in the family room watching television, they're cringing inside because there's discord and they think it's their fault.
Yeah.
Children internalize everything as my fault, which is why when I was doing marriage and family counseling, we were really stressing, don't fight in front of the children.
That's good advice.
Well, you rip out their foundation and they're just falling through space.
Oh, no, that's good advice. My wife would love to hear that, actually. She's had conversations about topics like that with me and saying, hey, if we ever have to, you know, hash something out, let's not do it in front of the kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It threatens their foundation because they're walking on an earth that's in love and they don't get it that you're not upset with them, that is mm-hmm. upset at a situation. But that's something that has to be taught to children.
Yeah. You know, one other thing, Leslie, I'm such a big fan of yours. The other day you shared with me your peer or patient sort of guide to help empaths, Houdini kids, or blindfolded bodhisattvas navigate their way through life. Mm. And, you know, and for some reason, particularly for blindfolded bodhisattvas who come in, don't necessarily remember that they are bodhisattvas, right? And then they're thrust into these environments of turmoil and fear and discord. And then even worse so, they don't have, you know, a supportive environment around them, like the bodhisattvas, a very good example, the Dalai Lama that you explained have. And so can you delve a little bit more about the value of this peer or patient guide that you created in helping sort of bring back to balance some of this discord that Houdini kids, empaths, blindfolded bodhisattvas might mm-hmm. be experiencing?
Well, one of the things that we all make a mistake in constantly, even when we're aware of it, is we expect, like all adults, to be grown up. Houdini kids, bodhisattvas in general, but Houdini kids who don't know who they are people that are the adults because they're old souls and they are hard pressed to pick up hate or absorb hate. Anything that they pick up trying to fit in, they usually begin to drop off by high school, college. Having to do with that exercise, peer or patient, this came out of my marriage counseling because I realized in many difficult relationships, you have one person being the adult and the other person just kind of riding on the coattails until the adult gets so tired of being the teacher in the classroom syndrome and wants an adult to share life with, which is usually in the 35 to 45 age group. If we're developing correctly, we don't want to be surrounded by students anymore. And then there's conflict. When you look at people from the point of view of a bodhisattva, you love everyone. It's unconditional love. They embody unconditional love. And the nice thing is equality is morphing from based on sameness to oneness. And so then you have everyone is one. And we're beginning to really manifest that. And that's accelerating with these millennials and Generation Z because they're raised globally on the internet. They're not so quick to discount that. So the peer or patient exercise is how to have very gentle boundaries because, you know, you see a lot of things on the internet and one of the things I find is that everyone is pushing unconditional love and not understanding the side effects of allowing, it could be a family member, a neighbor, someone you're dating. If they're dysfunctional and filled with a lot of rage, they are definitely not going to be people that can handle an adult relationship. And the example I always give is let's take Charlie Manson and throw him back 2,000 years into ancient Rome. They would have thrown him into the Colosseum and tortured him to death for entertainment. Thank God, and I mean that literally, that we've evolved and we take someone like him and we say, you are God's son. Because unconditional love looks at every human being, rich or poor, healthy or unhealthy, whatever happens, you're all one. You are all God's son or daughter. But we take God's son in Charlie Manson form and we stick him in prison. Now, let's say somebody called you up and said, well, you know, he's going to be 75 and he's been in prison 30 years. Why don't you just take him home for the weekend? And, you know, we'll pay all the expenses. Who would say yes to that? Not a functional person. And we would kind of pull back because who wants to be vulnerable to someone who's that dysfunctional? So when we look at unconditional love, in my opinion, it should not include vulnerability, neither emotional, physical, or financial vulnerability with someone who's dysfunctional. A lot of people will go into business with a friend or a family member because they've made it and they're trying to help this person out. And then the whole thing goes bottom up. It's just allowing to, again, one of the strongest sentences to double check, is this blank in my highest good too? It's just learn to include yourself in your decisions. If your best friend calls you at 3 a.m. and their car broke down, they can't get Uber, we don't ask it. But this is like when we realize someone is tapping into us a little too much, you know, and when I see the name on caller ID and I go, oh, I don't want to pick it up. Is this relationship in my highest good too? Because we're not allowed, I'm a psychologist, we're not allowed to date our patients. We're not allowed to treat or hang out like friends with our patients. We're not allowed to treat family members. You know, we have a objectivity buffer that we can refer people, but we can't treat them. Same thing with dating. I always tell people, accept them as they are or move on. You have no right to change them. And people who are empaths who are flooded with this unconditional love will oftentimes fall in love with potentially what could be rather than accept them for as they are. And so that's one of the things that this exercise does on my webpage, because it's teaching people how to have very general boundaries. Everyone you know is either your peer, and if they're not, then they're your patient. And the reason I use patient is when we think I'm mentoring this person, that's okay, then I have a little bit of that buffer in place. If we meet people, we should be objectively observing how they walk their talk before we put them on our jugular vein, because unconditional love puts everyone on our heart. I don't want to put a scorpion on my heart. I want to love it at a distance. Just like Charlie Manson, I'll leave him in prison. Thank you very much. I'll send him a cake if you want, but I'm not taking him home with me.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that. They're gentle boundaries.
Yeah.
But we, paths and Houdini kids, need to have boundaries, but then they feel guilty because they think I'm discriminating against them. No, you're unconditionally loving everyone you know. What I call intimate love means I'm vulnerable now is for my peer groups. Same integrity, same open optimism for life and the desire to learn and grow and better themselves till they die. Those are keys that make happy adults. And we want to make sure we're vulnerable to our peer group and anyone else. We love them from a distance. We can help them when they need it. We can pray for them, but we're not vulnerable. That's the key word.
Indeed. And to build up on that, Leslie, one thing that really keeps coming to mind, and this is my understanding again, is in listening to you explain how important it is to set boundaries. I think it's also important to know thyself. That's what I pick up. If you know yourself well enough, then you can start to discern who in your social circle is your peer, your patient, and then you can quickly and even better start to discern when the things that you're doing for either one of these groups of people is not always also for your highest good.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good point, because some people give so that they can feel powerful. That's not bodhisattvas. They're egoless. Mm-hmm. People give because they think it will get them into heaven. Again, that's not a Houdini kid or bodhisattva. They give because it's the right thing to do. They just do right. They just do it different. They find something, they bring it and go, who dropped this, rather than grab it and run out the door. It's people, there are lots of different, again, going back to what you said, the world is a one-room schoolroom. And you've got everyone in one room from baby playgroup to PhD. When you look at your family, you can realize who are the ones that are more selfish and argumentative, who are the ones that are selfless. And those, that's the younger versus older. So we begin to unconditionally love everyone. So I had a client and her neighbor, who was her best friend since like kindergarten, but this was her, I think her third marriage, and she's married to an alcoholic. So she would come over for coffee and cry, Paul's drinking again. And she learned that you stop giving advice to people who are glued and holding on to their melodrama, and you twist it into asking questions. You can give them love. You can give them a hug and say, oh, you poor thing. But you don't get caught up. As soon as you start giving advice to someone, it's like a whirlpool. You've just jumped in. And there are things in life that we call the martyr complex in psychology, people who want to suffer because it gives them a voice. So when we get someone like that and we give them a hug and we say, oh, you poor thing, gee, how did you feel when you found him passed out? And then she's going to go, what do you think, Bob? And then she'll answer you. And then you'll, because now we're treating her like a patient. We don't give advice. We ask questions. And then we say, ultimately, a couple more. And then, what are you going to do about it? No words. And they go, and they're floundering because usually we've already jumped in. We're giving them lots of advice. And now we're saying, you got this. And that's actually the healthiest thing that we can do. It's loving. We're still being gentle and giving them sympathy, but we're not giving advice. Mm-hmm. And sometimes say, why? Well, I don't know. What do you think I should do? At which point you have to say, gee, I don't know. Pretend you don't know. And then say, if it were me, which is much more easier for them to assimilate rather than, well, you should do this. You just say, if it were me, I would go to AA for spouses, because it's free, it's a great program. That's what I would do.
Yeah.
Now, every once in a while, I had a client do this with her sister, and her sister came back at her and said, you're not giving me advice anymore. Why aren't you doing that? And she said, because I have nothing different to tell you. It's the same story, and it didn't help you. There's a beautiful saying out there, and it's called, when the student is ready, the master appears. If you give advice to someone once, twice, I always go three strikes, you're out. If you've given the same advice two or three times and the person's not changing, then you have to recognize this is not my student, I am not their master. And then we switch into the patients where we ask loving questions and give them hugs and say, I'll pray for you. But we don't get caught up in that whirlpool that's around them.
Great advice. And all of this is available, of course, on Leslie's website. So please sign up. Go on there and pay and download the Pure Patient kind of exercise and do that for yourself. Now, one of the other souls you mentioned is kind of like new age souls, I guess, or like the super newest ones. You talked about indigo kids. And you said the blindfolded bodhisattvas were maybe a bridge between bodhisattvas and indigo kids. Can you elaborate a little bit on indigo kids?
Okay, so when I have that near-death experience and I was shown how we literally absorb the negativity to clear the way, and later on when I was on Earth, I asked my guides upstairs, I want a clearer picture of what you meant by that. Because when you're upstairs and you're talking to all these guides, everything they say makes perfect sense. And you come back down to Earth and you remember everything they said and you go, what did they mean by that? You know, so what they showed me was how someone would be allegorically laying in a swamp and being underwater. And as they raise themselves from the swamp, the land began to solidify. And when I had this vision, this was before I had ever heard of indigo kids, I could hear laughter because I pulled myself out of the swamp, then it became solid and I had to like dig myself out for the last, you know, get my legs out. And I heard laughter and I turned and I looked and there were, because all of a sudden all around me, the swamp was gone. It was solid ground covered with these tiny little yellow and white flowers, star-shaped flowers. And I hear giggling and I turn and there's these kids running and landing, hitting the ground running, and they're around 10 to 12 years old, 13 years old, they're preteens. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And then a couple years later, I'm hearing this buzz about indigo kids. And indigo kids, again, a third type of bodhisattva that comes down and doesn't need to drain the swamp. They're already here. And they are like the kids that you see that are 10, 12, 15, that are doing inventions, that are standing up and follow, you know, and becoming spokespeople for environment, or like Greta, or anything. It's like they already know. It's like you're totally assembled. And they just hit the ground running, and they immediately elevate again. They're lifting the top of the tent again, even higher, so we have more space for growth.
Ah. Now, when I hear this, it sounds like an evolution of basically the entire human race.
Yes.
And then it also speaks to a future in which eventually maybe the lowest grade of a soul incarnating on the planet would be this indigo kid. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, interesting, because they are bodhisattvas. But they're doing it like the Dalai Lama had to go through a lot of training to get to his level.
Mm-hmm.
Houdini kid was supposed to be behind the scenes just generating the energy for change. And the indigo kids are going more into the business world. And I'll give you another example. There was a very holy man in India, and I've written to the society to see if I can get the exact book, or I want to quote him. Is about 20 years ago, I read an article about Sri Aurobindo, is his name. And he had said, it's time for the holy people to come out of the monasteries and the temples, because for a long time, the pleasures and temptations of the material world would be too distracting.
Right.
So spirit went into these cloistered areas, solitary areas, and evolved. And now he said, and this was about 100 years ago, and he said, it's time for them to begin to come into the business world and, you know, own a restaurant. I mean, not like be a self-help guru, but literally just bring common sense, decency, fairness, why you have so much transparency. And then here we are a few years ago, Smart Money's talking about the new wave of these young kids that are building these collaborative businesses that are making more money than the old-fashioned competitive businesses.
Mm-hmm.
These children, the millennials and Generation Z, already know it. They don't have to go and sit in meditation. And so, like I said, I've written a society. If I ever get an answer, I will give it to you. But it was in one of his papers that I had read. And I just can't seem to work the internet well to figure it out.
I'll do my best to help you find it.
Well, I'll send you the sentences I remember, and then
okay,
do whatever you do. But we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But it was a beautiful, and it's very timely. It was a beautiful about 100 years ago, and then you can, when you look at that arc from like 1910. To 2010, from 1920, from 1900, you know, go 100 years, and you see all of a sudden how in the 30s, 20s and 30s, things began to mix up a little. We hit the 60s, huge mixing up a lot to change, you know, equality is oneness. And it's now these kids are coming that without even blinking an eye, they're just like going, no, that's wrong. Not only are they doing it, but they're becoming the leaders. They're the ones that stand and speak out and people follow or hate, either way. But they're not wavering from what they know is right.
Oh, that's great. And you do see that a lot now, you know, I kind of appreciate that of saying bringing spirituality from like the, you know, the mountains or the caves or isolation out into mainstream.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm excited.
Even little children, there's something all over the internet about a little girl. She's 6 or 7 and her neighbor got cancer. And so she's out there with her lemonade stand. And every penny she makes, she brings to her neighbor to help her with her cancer treatment, because there's certain things that the insurance pays for and there's other things it doesn't. And here she is, 6 or 7, and she's like, oh my gosh, I have to help.
Mm-hmm.
She figures it out. She asks her parents and they go, sure. And her parents are helping her by giving her the lemonade to sell. And she, every penny, she walks over at the end of each day and gives her the cash. It's most wondrous thing to see this little girl being so dedicated to help in such a profound, selfless way.
Yeah. No, that's great. Now, besides things like what this little girl is doing, usually where would you find Houdini kids in your mind, or even blindfolded bodhisattvas? Where would you usually find them?
Houdini kids tend to be very isolated, because when we were placing them, they showed me upstairs a vision of how I was placing them, and I was looking at a map. And you know how you look from the satellite at night and you see clusters of lights and then vast areas that are black? Now, this was looking at populations. People that were awakened or struggling to become awakened were the ones that were all light. But then there were areas where there was a lot of darkness in all the people. So we would take the blindfolded bodhisattva, put them right in the middle of the dark spot. And then when we're putting another one in, we didn't put it right next to it. We tried to find again. We're breaking down the spaces and spreading it out grassroots like seeds. You don't want the seeds next to each other. So Houdini kids are really isolated from a deeply spiritual person who is kind of like, I always say it's the ugly duckling story. Here's this beautiful swan who's trying to be a duck and then realizes at the end of the story that, no, I'm a swan, you're a duck, we're both fine, and then finds other swans. It usually is in their 40s and sometimes 50s and 60s that people begin to be attracted to they find the Houdini kids. And they find the other bodhisattvas that are elevated, because they are so programmed to be the teacher in the classroom. When they meet another teacher, there's a part of them that says, no. Anyone who says, I can't sit down to eat until everyone is fed in the world is probably a Houdini kid. And that's when we have to recognize that we're on a pathway of elevation and love and light. It's not going to happen in the next year or two. It's going to take a generation or two, but we're going in that direction. And you have to, that's why I say Houdini kids have to learn how to play. And in that play is when they start bumping into other Houdini kids. And it's like magical, because you're with people, you don't have to explain yourself, you can share yourself. And they love to hear it. And then they share themselves and you love to hear it. It's equal if you become very close friends.
Oh, great. No, that's beautiful. I appreciate you sharing. In addition, I'm really fascinated about the placing back upstairs, right? And what the map looked like, if you had protocols that you had to follow, other than, of course, you didn't want to put the light or the Houdini kids too close to each other. If the Houdini kids had a say, like, Leslie, no, I don't want to go over there. Maybe your name wasn't even Leslie at all.
No, it wasn't. I don't know what my name is upstairs. I know everyone else, but every time I meditate, I don't get it.
Yeah.
We basically, at this point, when you have such an old soul and they're volunteering to come, they're basically saying, put me where it will do the best for human consciousness. And what they showed me, there was this energy ball in the center of the table where we were talking, and they would show me kind of clips. And they showed me, and I had this little like bright yellowy orange light in my fingertips. And I'm kind of looking around to where the dark space was and trying to put it in the center of the dark space. And then you'd be placing the second one going, okay, so here's 6 inches between light. So I'm going to put it in the middle. Now there's 3 inches. So I'm going to go 1.5 inches. You'd always be spreading it, but it would take at least 100 years before everything would erupt. And there you have the 60s.
Wow.
Because that was 100 years before that we started placing the Houdini kids. And then all of a sudden you have people that are saying enough. In the 30s and 40s, there was a lot of lightness that got clamped down on in after World War II. It was like, no, you're going to be this, and you're, and all of a sudden it's like clamping down on a stereotype, creating stereotypes. And then you have television that's telling us stereotypes subliminally. And finally in the 60s, the kids said, enough is enough. We need to make our own choices. We got to vote. When I was young, you couldn't vote till 21. Mm-hmm. They could send you no more, but you couldn't vote about it. So, and there was just, you know, civil rights and organic farm and women's rights. The ERA still hasn't passed. It's all those things together, equality. And that's what we were fighting for.
Yeah. No, beautiful. One last thing, Leslie, before we kind of wrap up here, I think we're right at the edge. You know, we've talked a lot. We've talked, you know, Houdini kids, we've talked Indigo kids, we've talked Bodhisattvas and Ascended Masters. But I'm kind of curious about the idea of literally absorbing negativity to clear it away, right? Because at the end of the day, that's what these Houdini kids are here doing. They're kind of working to raise consciousness to, you know, like you said, elevate the tent. Can you speak to that a little bit more as you know, a kind of a way to close in maybe detailing one or two good ways that Houdini kids could begin to employ to help them not feel so out of sorts in their current life today, especially the ones that don't remember or don't recognize that this is who they are.
Right.
Yeah.
The very first thing is the foundation of that peer or patient, which is you have to have gentle boundaries. When I have a peer of mine that calls me to talk and she's or he is on their knees and they're upset because life just got nasty, I can jump in there with them because they want to heal. And then you have to differentiate between a martyr complex, which is very tied to their suffering. In fact, in college, we spent a full semester on the martyr complex because you have to know right away. Nobody goes to see a psychologist for a checkup. They only come in if they're hurting. Are you hurting because you did it to yourself because you want the attention? Or are you hurting because life threw you off the roller coaster? Because there's two different ways to teach. So one of the things we can do is with unconditional love, look at, is this person that's wanting me to help them, are they really working over a few months? Can I see a difference in them? Can I see them growing and dropping? Are they absorbing the lessons? So in my opinion, if any of my anyone I knew fell on their knees, I'm going to jump in there and help them once. They do it again, I'll jump in 100%, lift them up a second time, do everything I can to help them. Third time is when I stop. I don't ignore them, but I don't jump in right away. It's kind of, I begin to say, maybe they don't want to change. Maybe this is not my student. And on the fourth down, I punt. No, I'm kidding. I love to refer people.
Yeah.
And I know someone that could help you with that. If you want, and they go, well, when I'm ready, and then it might be 10 years before they say, what was that name? And that's okay, because everyone has their own curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to, if we can include ourselves in our decisions, that will make 50% of your decisions easier. So if someone is requesting something, or you're in a relationship where you keep getting gaslighted, or they're dumping on you all the time, or picking at you, you got to be able to say, is this relationship worthy of my jugular vein, or should I love them at a distance and be polite to them, but I'm not going to take on what what they're doing. That's their stuff. So it's all about just having gentle boundaries, unconditionally loving everyone from a safe distance. But the people, whether it's friends, family, romance, or business, if you're vulnerable, you can only be vulnerable to your peer group. Same level of maturity, emotionally and spiritually, same attitude, same, you respect them. The more you know them, the more you go, wow, I just respect how they handle themselves.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I appreciate you sharing. And you could not have really closed that any better. And I'll just add by saying, if you're listening to this and you heard anything she said and you're kind of curious to say, well, based off of the way my life is going, I feel like I might be, you know, a Houdini kid or something. Please check out Leslie's website, lesliejoanlupo.com. I'll have a link to that in the notes section of this podcast. And in the e-course section is where the peer or patient, lesson is. And please download it, go through it. It's amazing. And then you can always just connect with Leslie through her website. She's on Facebook, she's on Twitter, she's on Instagram, and get to know her that way. Above all, please grab her book. Remember, Every Breath is Precious. I read it in like 6 hours. And I was smiling from ear to ear the whole time. And it's just a fascinating book. So, yeah. No, Leslie, thank you so much for guesting again and talking to us about Houdini Kids.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. And guys, you know how to connect with me, roland@chenjiang.com. Please get a copy of Who and Why You Are. And I'm on Instagram as well as Facebook @roland@chenjiang. And until next time, have a wonderful day. Thank you.